Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Esquire Coaching Radio, where we help attorneys achieve unparalleled personal and professional success. And now here's your host, Ann Jenrette Thomas.
Hello, hello, everyone. Welcome to the Esquire Coaching Radio Show. It's such a pleasure to be here with all of you today. As you know, Esquire Coaching is a national coaching and consulting firm that is dedicated to empowering lawyers to happily succeed in the business of law. To that end, we discuss the full range of topics from building business to getting a job to work-life balance and everything in between. Today, we have a very special guest and a good friend of mine, Daniel Tan Esquire, who's going to talk to us about this unbelievably important topic, the aftermath of Freddie Gray, and where do we go from here. A little background about Freddie Gray before I introduce our esteemed guest. On April 12th of this year, Freddie Carlos Gray, Jr., a 25-year-old African-American man, was arrested by the Baltimore Police Department for possessing what the police alleged was an illegal switchblade. While being transported in a police van, Mr. Gray fell into a coma and was taken to a trauma center and died 1 week later. On May 1st, 2015, the Baltimore City State's Attorney, Marilyn Mosby, announced that her office filed charges against six police officers after they received a medical examiner's report that ruled that Gray's death was a homicide. On May 21st of this year, a grand jury indicted these officers on most of the original charges filed by Mosby, with the exception of the charges of illegal imprisonment and false arrest, and added some charges of reckless endangerment to all the officers involved. Freddie Gray's death has sparked a series of protests, especially when viewed against the backdrop of the deaths of Trayvon Martin, Mike Brown, and Eric Gardner, and countless other African-American men. Our esteemed guest, who's going to talk to us about where do we go from here, is Daniel Tan Esquire. Mr. Tan is the principal of the law offices of Daniel Tan, a general practice firm in Center City, Philadelphia, and he's known as the attorney for all generations. The firm practices in the areas of domestic relations, personal injury, criminal law, administrative law, real estate, wills, and general civil litigation. Mr. Tan is a skilled litigator, having practiced on the state and federal levels for over 25 years. He often takes on cases that other firms deny because he believes in justice. In addition to the practice of law, Mr. Tan is active in the American Bar Association, where he has served in the general practice, solo, and small firm division as a diversity fellow, chair of diversity, diversity director, and now is a member of the council which sets policy and procedures for the division. Additionally, he is a life member of Phi Beta Sigma fraternity, where he has served as Eastern Regional Director, International Legal Counsel, and currently is the Chief of Staff to the International President. His community involvements include board seats on Spectrum Health Services, LaSalle University Alumni Association, Camp New Joy, Market West Neighborhood Planners, African American Alumni Association of LaSalle University, to name a few. In his spare time, Mr. Tan is a student of politics, current events, football, and fine dining. Welcome, Mr. Tan.
Thank you.
All right. Do you mind if I call you Daniel on this broadcast?
You can call me Daniel or Dan, whichever is easiest for you.
Okay, great. So let's just dive into this really pressing matter and really upsetting matter. What was your first impression when you heard about the Freddie Gray incident?
Well, initially, just like everyone else in the country, it was, here we go again. And the initial thought process was that we're going to have another situation where there's an arrest, there's a murder, and there's no action. And fortunately, in this particular case, we had a mayor in Baltimore and a young attorney in Baltimore who took a different approach and came out on the backside with some action, which I'm very pleased to see that they were not afraid to do the right thing, conduct a thorough investigation, and come out with an indictment of police officers for violating the law.
It's true. And, you know, it's interesting that you said that, because this is a little bit of a shift from what happened in Ferguson and New York. Did you feel that this case was different from the cases in Ferguson and New York and the other cases that have recently involved young African-American males and police authorities?
I think there was a difference in the sense of the community involvement. If you look at Ferguson, you had more of a militia attack from the authorities. And you look in Baltimore, the mayor took a different stance, and she took a little heat about it in terms of she made a statement saying, well, let the looters do what they're going to do. And then she came back and said, well, I didn't mean it that way. I meant to let them blow off their steam for a little bit to get the anger out. And after she did that, order was restored to Baltimore. And unlike Ferguson and the other incidences, when the attorney general came out and did her investigation, she did a real investigation. She didn't come back with a lip service report saying, well, we understand the police didn't do things right. However, we're not going to indict anybody. She came out and she said, police didn't do it right, and we're going to hold them accountable. And I think that made a big difference in how the community acted going forward. Yes, they did. There were people there who burned and looted, but as in all the other cases, we're not sure those people were people from Baltimore or were they people from somewhere else. And that's the point that the media does not publicize, is that often the looters and the people burning are from elsewhere. In the Ferguson case, it was proven that some of the agitators were from other places and just came in because they wanted to see trouble.
It's really, you know, a bit disturbing and sad. I do understand and I agree with the notion of letting there be some space for the anger to come out. Now, every time there's a situation of this nature, we see looters. Do you have an opinion as to what should be done about the looters in general?
Well, I think when someone comes out to break the law, they should pay the penalty. I do not agree with looting. I don't understand the theory of if I'm upset at something that's happened, I'm going to burn up a neighborhood, particularly my own neighborhood, because
right.
If you look at Baltimore, they burn the CVS. So now Aunt Sally can't get her medication. And the young lady across the street who has an infant can't go to the store to get Pampers. So it doesn't make sense on that level. But more importantly, it's a violation of the law. So if they're caught, they should be prosecuted as well.
I absolutely agree. Absolutely agree with that. Now, you know, this is a really difficult subject. And I wanted to get your take on the title of this show, which is, where do we go from here? What is it that we can do as lawyers who are committed to justice, who are committed to civil rights and committed to improving our country? What is it that we can do differently in the aftermath that Freddie Gray and all of these other issues have brought to the horizon?
Well, I think one of the best things that we can do as attorneys is to educate the communities about their responsibility. And when I say that, I mean register to vote. And there's a correlation between registering to vote and being picked to be on a jury, and particularly to be on a grand jury. Many of these cases hinge on the fact that the information is brought by the state attorney general to a grand jury, which is a group of citizens who review the evidence and make a determination if an indictment should be brought. And if we're not a part of that process, we don't have a say in it. And the only way you become a part of the process is you have to be registered to vote, to be selected to be a part of the grand jury or the jury. So we can't, on the one hand, say that it's unfair, and on the other hand, not participate. And you have a choice. If you're 18 years or older, you can register to vote in most states. So we have to educate our communities to, when you turn 18, as a birthday present, here's your slip, register to vote. Then when you're called for jury duty, don't submit the form saying, well, I can't come because I can't get off of work or I'm scheduled for vacation. Do your civic duty. Show up, listen to the evidence, and make that right choice.
Wow, that is a great tip. I really love the idea of presenting it as a birthday present on the 18th birthday and getting involved. And speaking of, you know, once lawyers take this initiative and start educating the community, what, you know, there's been a lot of talk on different circuits about, you know, how can we create some cohesion, some understanding between police authorities and the local community. Do you have any thoughts on that, on, you know, whether there should be programs in place for educating police officers or anything of the like?
Yeah, I think that's a two-way street. I think that the police have to reach back out to the community and do some community programming. I know when I was young growing up in Philadelphia, we used to have police officers that walked the beat. That doesn't happen anymore. But I'm not saying that we need to have police officers walking the beat, but there are opportunities where the police officers can get involved in the community. They can come out to the community centers. They can sponsor some community events. My fraternity, Phi Beta Sigma, recently here in Philadelphia, we had a program dealing with Get to Know Your Law Enforcement, where we sponsored a program and we had members of the police department on the local and the state level come out and talk about what they do and how they perceive incidences and circumstances. And the community came out and had an opportunity to ask questions. And it was a good exchange, and it was sort of an icebreaker for the community to get an understanding of the stress level that police officers face on a day-to-day basis and how they can help and assist. And I think part of the problem is breaking down that barrier, because there is a barrier in certain communities that the police are not your friend. When I was a child, I was always taught that a police officer was your friend. If you were in trouble, find a police officer. I don't think that's the thought process anymore. It's sort of like, if you see a police officer, go the other way, because they may do harm to you. And I think the police have to take an aggressive marketing campaign and get involved in the communities. The community groups need to reach out and, when appropriate, bring the police officers in and have them get involved with what's going on.
Mm. And when you mentioned that when you were younger, police officers were walking the beat and essentially in the neighborhoods, do you think that that made an impact in terms of police officers understanding people in the neighborhood or getting to know the neighborhood better? Or what kind of impact do you think that it made?
I think it made a great impact, because now you don't have a police officer pulling up in a vehicle that does not know the individuals. If that police officer is walking that beat, he knows pretty much everybody in that neighborhood by name and face. And everybody knows that officer. He knows your family. He knows where you come from, and he knows your tendencies. So if he walks up on a Freddie Gray, he knows that's Freddie Gray, and I know his dad, and I know his mom. And if he's doing something wrong, maybe instead of arresting Freddie, I have a conversation with him, and then maybe I take him and talk to his dad in front of him and say, hey, we need to work together to get him on track. As opposed to now, police officers may or may not know who the individuals are in their respective areas. They see something that looks suspect. First thing they're going to do is pat down, arrest, and then these people are in the criminal justice system.
Wow, that, you know, it's a really interesting take, and I think it's a great idea for us to try and explore it and see if there might be an opportunity to bring something of that nature back, you know, back into the way that policing is done. If there's a real connection with the neighborhood and with the community, it just seems to make a lot of sense. Now, this trend that we, well, I can't say it's a trend. I feel like recently there's been more media coverage of this tension between police versus African American males. I think it's existed a lot longer than what the media has portrayed. But what is it that what's your take on it? Do you think that this trend of police versus African American males is something that will continue?
I think it probably will continue, and I think the reason why it's out there now is because of social media. 20 years ago, you didn't have a cell phone that could take a video and put it on the internet, and instantaneously, people across the country could see it. Things would happen, and it would be isolated to maybe the five people who were present and saw it. Those five people would go into court and say, hey, we saw it, and it would die there. But now, with social media, you can take that video, the news media picks it up, it's all across the world in a matter of seconds. And I think going forward, unless we take some affirmative action to really work on the problem and stop the issue of, you know, in Philadelphia we have this program called Stop and Frisk, which initially was initiated by an African-American mayor who thought that it would curb the drug problem in the city. And what it's really done is heighten the problem between the police and the community, because it gives the police the right to stop any citizen for no reason at all, just because they believe that a crime may be afoot. And it's not good, because what we found is that it's disproportionately used against African-American males. They could be walking down the street. You could be a professional college graduate with a suit, and if a police officer feels that you don't look right, they can stop you, frisk you, search your pockets, and if they don't find anything, they let you go. But if, hey, we found something, oh, we got something. And that's not a good practice. And fortunately, the Democratic-elected mayor candidate that was elected a few weeks ago has said that he wants to eliminate it. And a lot of the people in the city are in favor of eliminating, because it creates tension. And I think those types of policies, although they were intended to do a good thing, have resulted in a bad thing.
Now, what do you think about sensitivity trainings? I know that was big about a decade ago, but do you think that that would have any impact if police were mandated to go under sensitivity trainings and bring awareness to maybe their own possible prejudices?
I think that's an excellent idea. I think it should be mandatory, because you have to look at the background of a lot of police officers. I mean, I think it's one of the few professions where I commend police officers, because I would not want to do their job. But educationally, a lot of them do not receive a lot of formal education, but they put their lives on the line every day. So they come to that job with whatever baggage they were raised with. Some of them may have been raised in isolated environments, so they come to the job with those prejudices already in their head. So they may not have had a lot of exposure to minorities, or they may not have had a lot of exposure to certain communities. They may have preconceived ideas, and they may see things that don't exist, but because someone told them, oh, if you see this, this is what's going on. So I think a sensitivity training or curriculum ongoing, not just one time, would be helpful. I think also to have them go into the community and spend some time with some of the leaders of the community might be helpful as well, to get a feel for what really happens in this neighborhood and how things are done and who the players are, and to get a feel for the pulse of the neighborhood would be very helpful.
I really agree with that. Now, what about you're a political junkie. You just love it. Is there anything that could be done from a legislative perspective or policy perspective that could help curb these tensions?
Well, I don't know if it's a legislative thing, but I think police commissioners or whoever designs the curriculum for training, I've always debated with some friends who were police officers about the idea of a rotation where if a police officer is, say, on the street for 6 months, perhaps maybe they need a month off because part of their stress and frustration is that they work unusual schedules. A lot of police mm-hmm. officers will oftentimes work day work and then immediately switch to night work. And their schedules create a unusual sleep pattern for them. So in addition to the stress, a lot of them don't get rest at home. And then they're dealing with what they see every day, which is oftentimes not good things. And then they don't have time off. So I think within there, we need to maybe build in some significant time off. And within that significant time off, maybe some, as you would say, sensitivity training and maybe some psychological training to just see how this is affecting them to see if they're fit to be back on the street.
That's a great point, especially the psychological. You know, I mean, there's growing recognition and acceptance of post-traumatic stress disorder, and I'm assuming that just you don't need to go through a large trauma to still suffer the effects of that and have the impact of that, which could include a quick trigger finger, for example. So I think what you're raising is just a really interesting and holistic, a very practical approach to addressing the issue. Now, you know, as we mentioned, this is not a new issue. What would you advise young African-American men to do when they encounter law enforcement?
Well, I think the first thing is to be respectful. The mm-hmm. second thing would be to listen to what law enforcement is saying to them. You know, a lot of times they go on the side of being macho, for a better word, and try not to follow what they're being told. You know, oftentimes something may be going on that they don't know about, where an incident may have occurred and they may fit a profile and the officer is legitimately doing their job and investigating. So rather than to give the officer a reason to do something, just follow along. If the officer stops you in your car and says, "Can I see your license and registration?" You know, some people have suggested that you should put your registration and license in a carrier in your visor above your driver's seat so that you're not reaching in the glove box, so that you don't have to say, "Officer, I'm going in my glove box to get the registration and license," because a lot of times that's construed, "Oh, he was reaching for a weapon." If it's in the visor, you can just flip the visor up and say, "Officer, my registration is in the visor. I'm flipping it up," and hand it to him. And remain calm and keep your hands on the steering wheel as much as possible until the incident is over. And generally, you'll be fine. Some people nowadays advocate for the cameras in the car that film everything that goes on, so that if there is something that goes wrong, it's caught on film. You know, growing up in Philadelphia, we used to get stopped all the time for no reason at all. And it was frustrating some of the time. Mm-hmm. And it's really part of the reason I became an attorney, was because we had many incidences where we would be out playing in the street and the police would come along and say, you get in the car. And no reason, and they would drive us to another section of town and say, "Get out of the car. We're not arresting you, but get home the best way you can," knowing that that part of the city was racially different and we would be subject to fighting our way home. And I just thought that was just wrong. So it sort of led me to do what I do today. So it's sort of one of those things where you have to think smart and be calm about it.
Yeah, that's a horrible story. And, you know, one of the things that strikes me is you are very calm. You are really measured in how you talk about this and the solutions that you provide. And that was a pretty, you know, that's a traumatic experience that you've just described. So aside from, oh, gosh, I guess I love how you channeled your experiences and made the choices to do something positive with your life and to give back and to really uphold the law. What about those who are experiencing some of these negative situations and at the same time they're just not, they're not able to be measured? They're not finding ways to channel it appropriately. How can the community provide support with respect to that, you know, with respect to the people who are struggling?
Well, I think the first thing is you got to tell somebody. Mm-hmm. Everybody has somebody that you go to, whether it's your parents, whether it's a mentor, whether it's a teacher at school, whether it's a minister. You have to let somebody know how you're feeling, because it's better for you to let someone else know what you're feeling than to act out. And perhaps the person you tell may have a resource for you to get some assistance. And even to the point, if you don't have someone, you walk into the office of your local city council person and say, I have a problem. You know, they're elected to uphold the law, to enforce the laws, to work for the people. So I'm always an advocate of, if I elect you, you work for me. Therefore, you have to listen to what I need you to listen to.
That's great. That's really great. So a lot of wisdom here in what you've shared. Any final thoughts that you'd like to just share with our audience about what action they can take so that these types of things are mitigated in the future?
I think the biggest thing is get involved in your community. You know, don't just sit in the house and read the newspaper and watch the news and say that's terrible. You know, join a group, join a community group, form a block committee, reach out to your local police precinct, ask for meetings with the police, sit down and tell them what you'd like them to do. Bridge the gap, be proactive about it. Don't wait for something negative to happen to have an interaction with them. Reach out and maybe create something positive so that
Beautiful.
It's not a bad thing, it's a good thing.
That is such great advice. And will you share with our listeners a little bit about your firm and how they could reach you if they'd like, if they have any questions for you?
Sure. We are located in Center City, Philadelphia. We do have a toll-free number, which is very easy to remember. It's 1-877-DANTANN, D-A-N-T-A-N-N. We are a general practice firm. We do everything from domestic relations, criminal law, real estate, civil litigation. And what we don't know and don't do, we will find you someone who is excellent at doing it. And as our slogan is, we are the attorneys for all generations. So we are willing, able, and capable to help all people.
That is so great. And as you can hear, listeners, Mr. Tan is a man of his word. He is very involved in the community and definitely committed to justice and committed to giving back. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Listeners, let's keep this conversation going. Join us on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. Tell us about your thoughts. Do you have creative ideas on how we can reduce these tensions and improve relations? You can find all of our sites right on our website, www.esquirecoaching.com. Next episode, we'll be speaking with Cindy Krieger of Krieger Cole Communications on public relations and the media. If you have anything that you'd like to submit for a request on our show, please feel free to email us at info@esquirecoaching.com. Until next week, be well, everyone.